It takes me a... Okay, so it takes me a second to get set up. So while that's going on, I would like you to look at this picture, and I'd like you to look at those rocks. See that young man standing there studying them? I'd like you to study them like he is for a minute. I'll be ready in a second here. What do you think about those stones? If you put one in your living room, what would happen to your house? Think about that. Like, they're not just random, are they? Or are they? Well, let me tell you what they are. Okay, you can bring the lights up. Those are stones that have been hidden for about almost 2,000 years. They were underground. And what you see in the background, you see a wall. That's a foundation of Herod's temple. That's series we had on the minor prophets that, you know, there was going to be a temple built. That's a smaller temple. And then Herod came along and he said, Herod was an amazing builder. He just built. And I'll build a temple and they'll love me, you know. So he built this massive temple. What you see is actually a retaining wall. This foundation, retaining wall, holds this platform together, which is now, whenever you see a picture of Jerusalem, you always see the gold building with the gold roof, you know. That's the mosque that sits in this huge platform. That's where the temple was. It was monstrous. And about 20 years ago, the Israelis started to excavate around the edge. And when they dug down there, they found this pile of rocks or stones. Do you know what these are? These are stones that the Romans threw over. And they landed in this heap. And the Israelis have just left them as they found them, as they dug down. So, as you look at these stones, and by the way, in case you want to know, that's my son contemplating them. As you look at these stones, let's ask ourselves a couple of questions. Like, okay, so there they are. What do we learn from them? We learned that Herod built. We learned that the temple was huge. We learn that the Romans threw them over. But what I would like us to think about is that these stones that we're looking at are a sign of a prophecy. These stones are a proof of a prophecy. And that prophecy comes from Jesus, who, as he left the temple area, walked across a little ravine, which is called the Valley of Kidron. You go across this little ravine, more or less, and then you climb up a rather steep hill called the Mount of Olives. And in Matthew 24, we have what is called the Olivet Discourse, which is Jesus talking to the disciples, because as he climbed the mountain, the sun kind of was at a certain angle, and it shone onto the temple, which was magnificent. And the disciples stopped and looked back, and they said to Jesus, "Oh, look at that thing. Like, it was amazing. It was beautiful. Glitter. It was just something to see. Look at this, Jesus. Isn't it something?" They're just up there looking at it, you know. Jesus is always doing this kind of thing, like counterintuitively pouring cold water on everything with some prophecy. Jesus says, "Do you see all those buildings? Do you? I tell you this. Not one stone, get it, will be left on another. Not one will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." And that's the meaning of that pile of stones. Because in 70 AD, the Romans came and they laid siege to Jerusalem. And they captured it. And they battled right on the temple grounds because that's where the Jewish people fought to the last person. When they captured it, they tore it down. Look at those stones. If you had been a disciple, or if you had heard that prophecy, now come on, be honest. Would you have believed it? Look at the size of these stones. And Jesus says, everyone's going to be torn down. You would go, well, Jesus is speaking figuratively. Right? He's just speaking figuratively. Not every stone of this unbelievably amazing building is going to be torn down. But there it is. It was left for 2,000 years, I think, as a sign to us that when Jesus gives a prophecy, it will be fulfilled. It will truly be fulfilled. And so, after he says that, the disciples say, well, there we go. When's that going to happen? Tell us some more about this. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And so then Jesus goes into this discourse in which he, at almost at the end of his ministry, gives us these things. He tells us what will be the signs of his coming and of the end of the age. And I would like to show you two. I think there's two basic ones. There's a whole bunch. And you get lost in the Olivet Discourse because there's all kinds of prophecies of what we consider to be the Antichrist, of the destructions, of all kinds of things, signs in the skies and everything else. But I think they all coalesce. You have to sort them out under two main ones, two main prophecies. I want to talk about the first one just briefly, which connects to what the pastor says. But I want to ask ourselves, what are the rocks or the stones in our day that prove that Jesus was telling the truth? That Jesus' prophecies are coming to pass. That there's two signs. So, the first is, there we go. Nope. Give me the next one. There we go. The first one relates to what we just heard about from our pastor. Just to pick up on that, this Easter, 2019, families in Sri Lanka gathered. They were Roman Catholic families. They got up on Easter morning and went to church. And when they came into church, there was an explosion, not only in their church, in St. Anthony's Church, but in two other churches, in three churches, a bomber, suicide bomber, set themselves off right in the midst of an Easter celebration. One witness said, I started to rush in to help. The priest came out. He was covered in blood. There was blood everywhere. All over the world, as we've just heard, and we'll hear more in the next few weeks, all over the world, there is an outpouring of massive persecution and terrorism against the Christian church. And I would propose to you that is one of the piles of stone in our day and age. Because Jesus prophesied it. And we might just say, you know, here's the thing. I grew up with kind of an attitude in the church that was a little smug. This was a prophecy that was yet to be fulfilled. And we didn't need to worry about it too much. White, safe, American Christians. Don't have to worry too much about this prophecy of persecution. In fact, the Alliance pastors have a little closed Facebook group, and on it, somebody got worried about a threat from a politician this week that, you know, maybe tax exemption might be taken away from churches. And someone wrote in, well, that's a sign of persecution. And another Alliance pastor, to his credit, said, really? We're going to count taking away our tax exemption as a sign of persecution? Like, that's not persecution. You know, that doesn't quite meet the bar yet. But as we understand the church worldwide, we understand that Jesus' prophecy is being fulfilled. That what you heard yesterday at the Voice of the Martyrs conference, what we read daily, well, maybe not daily, but is happening daily. In USA Today, in New York Times, in major news outlets, these are signs to us that what Jesus said about the next, about the future is coming true. So that's the first prophecy in the Olivet Discourse. But the second prophecy, it's like we're going to do a lot in the church with persecution, so I'm going to move on past that pile of stones to the second prophecy. And the second prophecy is perhaps a surprise, because we might think that, well, you know, after the persecution, which is the object of the persecution, is to discourage Christians and to destroy Christianity. And to be truth be told, Christianity has been wiped out in some geographic areas through church history. It has happened. And so we might think, well, really, if that prophecy comes true, then the church will just get weaker and weaker around the world, and it's going to get smaller and smaller until maybe Jesus will come and rescue the church and then we'll be okay. But actually, the second prophecy, which is a core prophecy of the Olivet Discourse, surprises us. And it is, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. This is the prophecy that answers the disciples' question. What is the sign of your coming? Yes, persecution. But then Jesus tags on to this one, and then the end will come. Are these two prophecies connected? Just for a little bit of understanding of the text, I think they are. Because when you're a little church of no count, you're just a little group of believers that never squeaks, never bothers anybody, why bother persecuting you? But churches that grow, churches that become strong, churches that sweep in thousands into the kingdom, they become a threat to the world's leaders. And so they rise up in wrath against them. So first of all, I want us to notice the words all nations in this prophecy. All nations. We could easily translate this verse, all ethnic groups. That would be a legitimate translation. In fact, it is what you might call a literal translation, because the Greek word, which I don't usually, the Greek word is ethnos. All ethnic groups, we would say in English. All ethnic groups. This concept is echoed throughout the entire Bible. So we notice, for example, and Pastor Dan walked us through this a little bit, but let's just do it again. Maybe I'll pick up a couple extra verses. So we understand that this is not a side theme of the Bible, but it is what you might call the golden strand of the Bible. Genesis 12:3, to Abraham, all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you. Psalm chapter 2, verse 8, I will make, a prophecy concerning Jesus, by the way, Psalm 2, I will make the nations your inheritance. Revelation, so now we notice we're starting with Genesis, middle, end. 5:9, with your blood you purchase men for God from every tribe, language, and people, and nation. Some of in contemporary missions speak of this as God's mission. It is the mission of God to bring salvation to the people of the earth. He is going to give to His Son Jesus the nations as His inheritance. That's His inheritance to do that. And I want to say this morning that we live in a day and age when these prophecies, all through the Bible, and specifically the one given by Jesus on the Mount of Olives, are being fulfilled. People who have been held so securely by many of the world's religions are beginning to change to Christianity. As the world's fastest growing religion, Christianity is being considered today by millions of people. To understand the rapid growth of Christianity in our day and age, I would like to walk us through just a little bit of history. Is that okay? Hang on. Here we go. Let's consider, first of all, the 1,000 years that it took to bring Europe to Christianity. Oh, man. Like, did you ever think about that? I always sort of thought just Europe sort of woke up one day and decided to be Christian or something like that. That's not what happened. So I have some dates here. 313, as it took 313 years working around the Roman Empire, and there's a whole thing about, you can do a whole chart on the growth of Christianity in the Roman Empire. But by 313, Christians were strong enough that the Emperor Constantine issued what he called, what is known as the Edict of Milan. He was in this because he was in Milan at the time, which made it possible for Christians to be a legal religion and to be okay in the empire. 100 years later, Patrick goes to Ireland. Okay? So now we're in the 400 years after Christ, and we're bringing Christianity to Ireland. All right? In 988, Vladimir, the king of the Russians, was baptized. I actually had one of the cool things was if you're in Sevastopol, in now the Crimea, used to be in Ukraine, but Russians took it over again. But you can actually see the baptismal fountain where Vladimir was baptized. This is 700 years after Constantine, okay? And Christianity comes to Russia. And then February 15th, 1385, I'm not good enough in Polish to say his name. Anybody can do that? No? No Poles? Okay. We'll call him Jogaila. Close enough. King of the Poles was baptized, and he brought Poland and Lithuania into the Catholic Church. This is 1,000 years after Constantine, 1,300 years after Christ. This was the last European country to enter Christianity from paganism, from some kind of paganism, that is, worshiping idols and all that sort of thing. Personally, I don't think, because of the way this happened, king decides everybody's going to be a Christian. I don't think Christianity really took root and began to spread in Europe until the Reformation. That would be like 500 years ago. And some might say it never has. But anyway, we won't go there. So it took this much time, this is the point, for Christianity to move through Europe. All right? Got that? 1,300 years from Christ, 1,000 years from Constantine. Now look at this. This is a chart of the rise of Christianity in Africa. Notice the dates. 1900, and by the way, we're looking at the gold line. In 1900, 9% of Africa, we're talking about a continent here, 9% of Africa was Christian. By 1960, watch that graph go up. Watch it go up to 2010, 57% of Africa in 100 years. You move from 10% to over 50% of a continent. That's, now what I'm trying to get you to understand here, or grab, is the difference in speed. A 1,300 years from Christ to the last king in Europe saying, our people are going to be Christians. And maybe more before you actually have evangelism going on. Here, a little over 100 years, and a continent is being swept into the kingdom. This is just amazing. This is just amazing. So I'm going to just leave that up because I don't know how, and we won't stop to bother how to just turn the screen blank. So just ignore the screen for a while. I want to talk to you about South Korea. We've probably heard a bit about South Korea, but it's worth visiting South Korea again. I first visited it when I was a pastor. I was going to teach some theology and something else in our Alliance Seminary in Manila. I was flying Air Korea, so they let me stay in, to have 2 days in Korea free. You could get off the plane and get back on, so they thought that would be a good way to, for me to give more money to the economy. So I did. So we had an alliance worker working in South Korea at that time in Seoul. I went and visited him, and I learned a lot about the church there. So in South Korea, in Seoul, churches are not just in buildings. There are buildings, but they're in office buildings. They're in apartment buildings. Some years later, I made another trip, and I was in my son's apartment, and I heard singing. And I recognized they're singing a hymn in Korean. There was a church about 9 o'clock at night, off in some other body else's apartment, singing and having church service. It was great. But no matter where the churches are in South Korea, they put a red neon cross on the roof. If it's an office building, a neon cross goes up on the roof because there's a church meets there. And so on. It's just a custom. I didn't really get that until I took an elevated train about dusk and all those crosses lit up. And I looked over the city and saw red neon crosses just by the hundreds and thousands across Seoul. And so here's the thing. In 1900, going back, same date that we're using as a starting point for Africa, 1% of Korea's population was Christian, 1900. In 2014, Pew Research Group estimates 29% of the population of South Korea is Christian. That's a jump from 1% to 29% in 110 years. That's just amazing. Like, it's amazing by any kind of measurement that you might want to have. Today, of the 12 largest congregations in the world, 11 of them are in Seoul, Korea. And South Korea is also the world's second largest missionary-sending nation. We send more missionaries out of the United States, true. After us, South Korea. They predominantly go into what we call the 1040 window because they recognize the fact that as Asians, they kind of slip in or they have other treaties with that country and so on. Some of them have been murdered and killed because they go into such dangerous places. But for one more stat, let's understand this, that in 1974, South Korean Christians sent out 24 missionaries. 1974, 24 missionaries. Then, I don't know, something happened. The Holy Spirit spoke in some way to the pastors. It is estimated now that there are over 27,000 South Korean missionaries out. Okay, that's a jump. That's a jump, right? From 24 to 27,000 in 40 years. And they're everywhere. I mean, believe me, they are everywhere. They are in Vietnam, where we can't send America. We have people in there with AIDS and so on and so forth. They've got, I don't know how many missionaries in Vietnam, for example. And on it goes. Now, all of that to let you know, have you understand this, as something that encourages us, yes, but also as understanding that these things, and we could just do this story again and again, walking around the world, these are piles of stone that tell us that what Jesus prophesied is coming true as we speak, in our day, as we live. We are living through the fulfillment of these prophecies. Why? Because the Father has promised the nations to Jesus. And that promise will not be broken. And we might sit here and say, no, 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 Islam will stand against Christianity. No, no, Buddhism will stand against Christianity. No, no, we won't see churches arise in all of these countries. We won't see that happen. But to do that is to stand with anyone who would say, see this magnificent temple? Nobody's going to tear that down. Look at the size of the rocks. How would they ever move those rocks just to tear them down and throw them over the edge? How would they ever do that? They would do it because the Father had prophesied it. And this will happen, and it's happening before our eyes because God has determined it. So I want to talk about us as we close for just a few minutes. I'll have maybe a couple more stories. I want to talk about the Christian Missionary Alliance and our little church here, Eastgate Alliance Church, and its part in that. And I want to talk about how we participate in this fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy. Well, first of all, we try to follow a strategy that is outlined for us in the book of Acts. First of all, we seek to reach groups of people to whom Christ is not known. In the last chapter of the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul told the people in Rome that he hoped to come to them and then they would help him move on to Spain, which was the end of the world. Why? Because Paul is always looking out at the horizon, wondering who out there he could preach to new. In missions practice, these people are known as unreached people groups. And as an alliance church, we have been active through our history in trying to reach people to whom Christ has never been named. Here in Wisconsin, we have, as an alliance church, 17 churches, which when they're meeting this morning, they're meeting right now across Wisconsin, but they're worshiping in a language called Hmong. Those people were reached originally by Alliance missionaries who went by boat up rivers and whatnot into northern Laos. And from that, a huge, what we call as a people's movement, occurred where thousands of them became Christians. Because they worked with the Americans in the Vietnam War, many of them were allowed to immigrate here. And we have an entire district of these folks here in the United States with great church still there in Asia. I mention that only as one example of our effort to reach the unreached and the way God has blessed us. Secondly, that's number one. There we go. I suddenly remembered I had a PowerPoint. So, secondly, there we go. We seek to reach scattered people. An example of that is our efforts to reach Chinese people around the world. Chinese are the largest single identified as Han Chinese identifiable people in the world, ethnic group in the world, and they are everywhere. And we have sought not only to reach China, but to reach Chinese people in multiple places. I myself was able, blessed, I should say, to preach to a group in Tel Aviv. And I was there on a Friday night, and there was this group of men, all men, and because they are construction workers. Just like, you know, we bring in people from other countries to do hard work. The Israelis bring in Chinese, and they build their buildings. And we have an outreach to them in Tel Aviv. And one of the elders came up to me afterwards. He said, you know, one of these men became a Christian. We trained him in this Friday night session. We discipled him. He went back to China. He bought Bristol board. He drew pictures explaining the gospel on Bristol board. And he's gone from village to village up in some remote area of China, witnessing, bringing people to Christ, establishing Christians, churches. So that's part of the result of this effort of ours, this strategy of the Alliance, to reach scattered people as Paul sought to reach the scattered Jewish population in the Roman Empire. I'm just telling you that we're following the Acts strategies. Third, we try to reach leadership. And Paul was certainly no respecter of persons, but when he went to places, he always looking for the leaders as well as whoever else he could reach. He wanted to speak to them. We see that when he's in Crete, pretty soon he's in the house speaking to the governor of the island. We see that even when he's in prison, he's working his way through the hierarchy of the emperor's palace. We see that in multiple places in Acts, that Paul's line of communication would thread its way to leadership. And we, in the Alliance, we have developed a model called marketplace ministries, whereby we go into countries with different kinds of things, such as starting businesses. We used to call it businesses mission. We now call it marketplace ministries. We keep rebranding, but it's the same thing. We go in and we do that, and we seek through these things to train people, raise them up, and to begin to impact the leadership of the country. I'm moving right along here. The last one, make sure we got that, is our effort to reach the poor and vulnerable, which we do through a branch of our alliance called CAMA. That is, they rebranded this also, so I have to just check it. Compassion and Mercy Associates. Got it. Compassion and Mercy Associates. It got rebranded, so that for that I kind of got lost. But CAMA does amazing things. CAMA is in Bermuda. Right now I'm working with a hurricane. They start businesses. They bring all kinds of mercy and compassion ministries, starting things to make development that help people get on their feet. And in all these ways, seek to bring Christ to people. At the end of the sermon, we're done here almost. We want you to join. Your pastor wants you to join. The Alliance wants you to join. Jesus wants you to join. He wants you to join in this effort. He doesn't want you to be a bystander, so when you get to heaven, Jesus says, and by the way, you lived in the most important time in church history as I was bringing everything to a climax as the gospel raced around the world. And you did what? You were part of it? We want to say, yeah, we were part of it. In some way, we joined in this effort. I believe in the coming generation, it is possible that we would see the complete fulfillment of this prophecy and the gospel being preached and lived in every ethnic group and every language in the world. And we are being helped by that. It's not just an American white man's burden. Not at all. Koreans are out there. The Africans have a vision for re-evangelizing Europe. We are an active Christianity, but we want to be part of it. Today, I'd like you to think about your life. I'm going to pray at the end. We're going to have a moment of silent prayer. But I'd like you to think about, how can I be involved? Ask yourself, is God calling me to involvement in some way? Because, brothers and sisters, you were born in this age for a reason. For a reason. That's why your birthday is what it is. Because God determined your existence at this time at the end. So what is it? It's to be part of God's great movement of going out and finding lost sheep. That's what it is. I'd like you to pray. Perhaps you could be involved in short-term missions in some way. We send out short-term missions. Maybe you could be involved. Maybe you have a skill or profession that could be used to get involved in marketplace ministries. You could go and contribute your skill or profession. I know we have some medical people who do that here. So I'm not saying we're not doing it. We're an Alliance Church. We're active. But I'm saying, can we become more? Perhaps you could become involved practically in one of our compassion ministries here and around the world somewhere. Or maybe God is going to speak to you to leave us and go someplace and become part of that beautiful group that Isaiah talks about, who spreads the good news directly. So I'd like us just to take maybe 30 seconds or 40 seconds. Let's close our eyes and ask the Lord, Lord, is there anything for me here? Holy Spirit, come to me and speak to me. Can I be involved in some kind of way that I haven't been? Can I help to accelerate the kingdom's growth? And if he gives you an answer, tell him you're willing to do that. Tell him you're willing. Give him your heart. Jesus, let us be completely yours. We believe you. We believe your prophecy. Help us to be faithfully part of it. Amen.